How does this sound as a plot line for the next James Bond movie? Five countries, led by the United States, listen to all phone calls made everywhere in the world and read every email using a mysterious system with the code name Echelon. Does that sound a bit far-fetched? Well, Patrick Radden-Keefe has researched the very real world of signals intelligence for his new book called Chatter, and the book is published by Random House. He joins me now on the Leonard Lopate Show. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Isn't the subject of your book the result of an agreement between five English-speaking countries? It's only English-speaking countries?
That's right. They do occasionally pass on information to other countries, allied countries. But this goes right back to the end of the Second World War, when the U.S., the U.K., Canada, Australia, and New Zealand all agreed to sort of split the world up and set up a surveillance system that would listen in on communications all around the planet.
Of course, communications were very different then.
They were, and it's gotten, it's interesting, it got much easier to intercept communications with the advent of satellite communications in the 1970s, and it's now getting a bit harder again as things return to the wires with fiber optic.
So fiber optics makes it more difficult. For what reason?
Because you actually have to tap the cable. I mean, the thing about signals that are sent through the air, so microwave like your cell phone would use or anything that goes over satellite, is that the signals are right there in the air. It's very easy to pick them up.
But in the old days, they had to tap the telephone lines and the telegraph lines, didn't they?
They did. They did. And it's now returning to that sort of espionage again.
I've seen references to the National Security Agency over the years, but I'm not exactly sure what it does. How are they involved in all of this?
Well, the National Security Agency basically runs this network that I'm writing about. It's amazing. Most Americans haven't even heard of it.
Including some famous reporters you mentioned.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't want to mention the names and embarrass them.
But the joke is that the National Security Agency, NSA, stands for No Such Agency. The funny thing is it's actually bigger than the FBI and the CIA combined.
And how different is its mission than the CIA or the Defense Department's intelligence operation?
Well, entirely different. I mean, when we think of spies, we think of people in trench coats sort of parachuting into foreign countries. And what's amazing is that the reality today is it's much more people sitting at computers with headphones on, listening to communications around the planet.
But if it's so big, how is it able to maintain such a low profile?
That's a good question. I mean, it's amazing. My book is the third book to deal with the NSA in the last 30 years, and the first two were written by the same guy. They have a real culture of secrecy that they've maintained. But it's incredible that they've been so effective in doing it.
Is there any congressional oversight?
There is some, but not enough. I mean, people back off. And I think the reason is, for instance, in 1998, there was a story in the newspaper, in a Washington newspaper, saying that we were able to listen in to Osama bin Laden's satellite phone. And the day the story came out, he stopped using the phone. So there's a real sense, both in Congress and in the press in this country, that we don't want to touch it. The other joke is that NSA stands for Never Say Anything.
Mm-hmm. But it didn't matter whether they were listening or whether they weren't. Weren't all of these Al-Qaeda correspondences done in a language that practically nobody can translate?
Well, that's one of the big problems, is that we're very good at collecting communications from various people around the world and very bad at sorting through them and translating them. So, for instance, the FBI, it came out late last year, is sitting on 200 hours of taped conversations that they've taped between Al-Qaeda suspects that they haven't translated.
From Baluch? Or isn't that the language?
Baluch is one of the dialects that they use. I mean, people talk about Arabic, but Baluch, for instance, is only actually spoken by about 150,000 people in the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, there have been a number of reports of the fact that we have a limited number of translators in this country to begin with. In fact, I understand the federal government is borrowing some translators from the New York Police Department to handle some project. So, how can they it's one thing for them to be able to listen in on everything. The only people they're really going to understand are you and me.
This is true, and it's a real, I mean, it's funny, we hear about the Navajo code talkers from the Second World War, and I always thought it was funny, we called them the code talkers, but they weren't talking in code, they were talking in Navajo. I mean, in that sense, a foreign language can be so impenetrable that it's better than the best code. And the agencies are trying to hire new translators, but it takes time to learn these languages, and it's not an easy process.
How would they even decide what things to translate?
Well, the way they do it is they focus in on particular communications, emails, phone calls, particular people that they're looking for, and then they've sort of culled the stuff that looks like it might be of intelligence interest. They then translate that as rapidly as they can, but so far they've been pretty slow, as the FBI story would indicate.
And how do they know what to cull?
Because they target particular people. I mean, it's much more difficult when you're intercepting phone calls than email, because, for instance, with email, we have the technology to spot certain words or patterns of words, even when you use Google. Google is within seconds turning up the billions of websites that mention the word you're looking for. With spoken speech, it's much more difficult. So it's not easy for them to just listen to billions of communications and isolate the ones that they're interested in.
Are they really listening to every telephone call and reading every email, or at least do they have the capability of doing that?
They have the capability to listen to a great deal, and particularly with satellite, the way they do it is just to, rather than isolate one particular thing, they literally will collect all of the communications being bounced over a given satellite. I think of it as like putting a cup out in the rain. I mean, you just sort of collect it as it comes down. But increasingly, I think what they're finding is that the bigger and bigger haystack makes it harder to find the needle, and so they're going to have to be a little bit more discriminating in what they collect.
I can't even imagine, considering how many telephone calls I get and how much junk email I get, that anybody would care about most of this stuff or would want to gather it.
Well, that's the thing. And even with suspected terrorists, a lot of the time, we know that in some cases they actually know we're listening, so they send out false alarms. And in other cases, we just don't know what they're talking about. So, for instance, a few years ago, there was a big panic here in New York because it was thought that there was going to be an attack on the subways. And so we had thousands and thousands of cops deploying all over the city and all of these protective measures taken. People were quite panicked, if you remember. And it turned out that that was because there was a conversation intercepted between suspected terrorists, and one of them had said the word underground. And from that, they deduced that there might be an attack. Of course, there never was.
What is Echelon, and how does it work?
Well, a few years ago, I started reading about this system in the British press. It was called Echelon, and it was basically a global system for sorting through all of these communications that were being sucked up by these five allies.
That's the one that looks for the words like underground and gets all excited?
Yes, and would search for keywords. And it's actually based on an agreement that goes back 50 years, and it's a real sort of architecture for bringing these in. I mean, it's astonishing. The National Security Agency has about 40,000 employees who work in Maryland, but another 20,000 who work around the world at these listening bases that are in different countries all around the planet, just sort of hoovering in these communications.
My guest is Patrick Radden Keefe. His book, Chatter, Dispatches from the Secret World of Global Eavesdropping. It is published by Random House. And this is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. As you said, this thing was put into place initially after World War II, at the onset of the Cold War. And I'm sure it was all structured to deal with the Cold War. And we've heard an awful lot about how intelligence gathering has fallen behind because it was structured for the Cold War, and now what it has to deal with is so totally different. So has it been quick to adjust?
It has not been quick to adjust. I mean, either before September 11th or, I regret to say, since. I think that there's a great emphasis on secrecy. There's a great emphasis on older technologies. There's not enough communication between... I mean, the problem with all this secrecy is that you get agencies that are isolated, really, from the outside world, from academia, from the high-tech community.
Should the eavesdroppers have been able to predict the September 11th attacks?
That's a difficult question. I mean, we do know that in the 3 months prior to September 11th, the National Security Agency intercepted 30 communications predicting some kind of imminent disaster or attack of some sort. It was fair to say that there was a sign that something was going to happen. Whether or not any of that would be actionable intelligence and say that something was going to... I mean, they, for instance, on September 10th, they intercepted two phone conversations between al-Qaeda members saying tomorrow is the zero hour and the match begins tomorrow. And it's a sort of well-known story since that they didn't translate these conversations till September 12th. But what would that have told us had we translated those conversations?
Right. It wouldn't have told us that the World Trade Towers were where they were going to crash the planes. But if that's the case, then why are we even spending these billions of dollars to gather this information?
I think that's a good question, and one that I feel strongly about. I think that we have a tendency as Americans, we like technology, and I think of it as trying to gather intelligence by remote control. We want to be able to do intelligence without ever leaving our couch. I think that that's a misplaced priority, and that we should really be training more human spies of the old-fashioned variety and more linguists who speak these languages.
Is this kind of surveillance being used against American citizens?
That's unclear. I mean, I think there's definitely the capability, and we know that the intelligence agencies have done so in the past. We often hear about during the 1960s and 70s, the agencies listening in on people who were opposed to the Vietnam War. But I mean, I also, there's a story, for instance, about a woman who was at one of the biggest British bases in England. It's a big listening station. This is in the 1980s. And there was a man next to her listening in on headphones to conversations, and he said, "Here, listen to this." And she put on the headphones, and she heard a southern accent, a man with a southern accent speaking a somewhat familiar voice. And she said, "Who's that?" And he said, "That's Senator Strom Thurmond talking in his office in Washington, D.C.
Why would they even care other than to find out about his personal life?
You wonder. I mean, it's unclear. What we do know is that because there are laws against the U.S. listening in on people inside the U.S., it's been suggested by several former intelligence people who've worked in these agencies that what the U.S. does, the way we get around this, is to just have our allies, our very close allies like the Brits, do the listening for us.
Well, there are all these computer software developments that allow for translation. Wouldn't we just put all of these things, not that I'm suggesting we should be doing this, but couldn't we just put it all through some computer and look for some keywords that way? First let it translate from the Baluch and the Pashto and all of the other languages that we don't have enough translators for?
Well, that's certainly the suggestion a lot of people are raising, and there's a huge amount of venture capital going into that particular area. The agencies are realizing they don't have the translators. It may take a while to train them, so perhaps there'll be some technological silver bullet. I think that's a fallacy. Having talked to people who actually do this kind of translating, people who speak these languages and the dialects in question and have actually listened in on conversations are very dubious about the idea that a computer will ever be able to read for tone, will be able to read for expressions, idiomatic ways of putting things. There are those who think that this is a solution. I'm skeptical about that.
Well, if they could listen in on a private conversation that Strom Thurmond was having, that would suggest that there are no limits on the ways that this technology can be used.
I think so. And I mean, even more disturbingly, it would suggest that there's not enough oversight of this sort of thing. When the House Intelligence Oversight Committee asked in the late 1990s for information about Echelon and how it worked, and whether or not it was being used on U.S. citizens, the NSA refused to give them the information.
What is it, FISA or FISA? I never
FISA.
Knew. FISA.
Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
What does that do?
Well, that was imposed actually in the 1970s after the big scandals from the 60s about listening on anti-war protesters and so on came out. And what that did was it erected a wall between law enforcement and intelligence work. And the idea was that you would use eavesdropping of this sort, which doesn't necessarily require a warrant, or if there is a warrant, it requires less probable cause. You wouldn't use it against individuals in a law enforcement sort of domestic context. Having said that, the Patriot Act is now kind of working to bring down that wall. There are many who think that that wall between law enforcement and intelligence was responsible for September 11th.
Was the Patriot Act written with FISA in mind?
Yes, I think so. And I mean, it's interesting because in the months after September 11th, there were many who came out and said, "We're doing too much eavesdropping and wiretapping and not enough old-fashioned human intelligence work." But if you actually look at the Foreign Intelligence, if you look at the Patriot Act, many of the provisions in it have to do with wiretapping and expanding these electronic capabilities.
Well, you cite some examples of egregious privacy violations in this book. First of all, I wonder how you can even learn about some of these things.
It's very difficult. I mean, part of what's interesting is that eavesdropping doesn't really leave any fingerprints. So when you're trying to chase down instances, I mean, a lot of the time we're just saying, we don't know. We know they're able to do it. We know that in the past they haven't been restrained by the law. So we don't know.
Although the FISA court is supposed to approve warrants for eavesdropping, are they rather free and easy with those warrants?
I think they've tended to rubber stamp things. I forget what the exact figure is, but in years and years of existence, they only turned down, I think, one case or maybe none.
What was the Shamrock program?
Shamrock was one of these programs that came out in these scandals from the 1970s, which was a major eavesdropping program in which Americans were listened in on, and their cables and telephone calls were listened in on by the National Security Agency. And this really ran the gamut from people who were actually perceived as some kind of a threat to people with supposed communist sympathies to anti-war protesters like Jane Fonda, or Dr. Spock actually had his phone tapped.
Well, we had Martin Luther King Jr.'s hotel rooms bugged, and basically what they came up with was private things, nothing about his politics. So that would suggest that there's, and that was used against him in a personal way. It would suggest that we've had a lot of abuses of this in areas that have nothing to do with actually coming up with real intelligence.
That's true, and I think it's part of the reason that we should really have more debate and discussion about these kinds of technologies, because they're so powerful, and they have such an extraordinary ability to get into our private lives that the idea that these kinds of technologies are being put to use without much public discussion, without much congressional oversight, and I should also say without much coverage by the press, is, I think, rather dangerous.
Well, let's look into that when we continue this conversation. My guest is Patrick Radden Keefe. His book, Chatter, Dispatches from the Secret World of Global Eavesdropping from Random House. We're back with Patrick Radden Keefe, who has written for the New York Review of Books, the Yale Journal of International Law, Legal Affairs, and Slate, and now has a book called Chatter, Dispatches from the Secret World of Global Eavesdropping from Random House. We are talking about how this applies now to the United States. You mentioned the U.S. Patriot Act. Actually, before that, we had the Total Information Awareness Program, didn't we, which caused a lot of trouble?
It did. I mean, that was actually an interesting case in which there was a lot of publicity, and Americans who read and heard about this system became quite uncomfortable. The Total Information Awareness, the idea was that you would basically pull together all the existing databases that are out there, public databases and private databases about people, so credit card databases and toll booth records and what have you, and pull them all together into what they thought of as sort of a metabase, so that you would be able to, if you were interested in finding out about some person, enter that person's name or social security number and come up with a whole assortment of information.
So my EasyPass entry through a toll booth would go into my record and they'd know that I was going south in New Jersey?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually, in its way, it's a fairly elegant idea if you think it could actually work technically.
This is John Poindexter's idea.
This was John Poindexter's idea. And the idea was basically that, yes, if I was interested in you, I could put your name into a database, and it would tell me your last 10 credit card transactions, where your toll booth records were, if you know, your EasyPass. If your phone had a global positioning chip in it, which many of them do now, it could tell me where you were at the moment I entered your name.
And what does the U.S. Patriot Act give them access to?
Again, it's records. A lot of it is expanding the ability to gather these records. I think that there's a push, and it's, I think, an ill-advised one. There's a sense that if we can just see and hear everything all the time, that'll be the way we prevent attacks in the future.
Well, the Bush administration says it's responding to a legitimate group of concerns by asking us to give up some privacy rights in exchange for ensuring our security.
It's interesting. I actually come down somewhere in between on this issue. I'm not so dogmatically pro-privacy that I think that privacy rights should trump security concerns at every turn. My problem is I feel as though the agencies and the authorities in this case are doing it in a sneaky way. I think that Americans would feel uncomfortable if they knew the extent of surveillance that was happening now and the extent of surveillance that is planned for the near future. Now, if we had some kind of a public discussion, a referendum, if our congresspeople actually talked to us about this, and we decided as a nation that we were willing to almost barter this, you know, X amount of security for Y amount of privacy, then I'd be all right with that. My problem is I feel as though that conversation is not taking place. We're not aware of this. And there's more public discussion and exposure that needs to happen.
Well, Congress just went along with the U.S. Patriot Act. A few people objected, but there has been more resistance to the second U.S. Patriot Act, hasn't there been?
There has.
So there's been some talk about this. There are concerns that we may be going too far.
There has, and on a local level, actually, a whole series of jurisdictions and municipalities have passed resolutions against particular provisions of the Patriot Act.
Like telling people what library books.
Well, exactly, and librarians actually really organized over that particular provision. But nevertheless, I feel as though if you read the newspaper, you don't see this. It's I think that these issues kind of, as with total information awareness, there was a big spat about that, and there was a lot of press coverage, and Congress actually kind of put the program out of commission. But what people don't realize is that since then, another program that aims to do very similar things called The Matrix. They always choose these weirdly ominous names. The Matrix program.
I saw that movie.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's not far off. But the Matrix program is now being adopted in various counties all over the country, doing very similar things.
Now, this has led people to be very suspicious. A listener called in to tell us that he went to Atlantic City and discovered that his room was bugged. I don't know how he knew, and I'm not sure that it really was, but people are thinking that way now, and they haven't thought that way in the past.
Yeah, I think that what I certainly found was when you start looking into this stuff, you become very paranoid. I mean, early on in my research, I met a man who drove me around in his car, and he's a former eavesdropper, a British man who worked for British intelligence, and he calls his car the Porcupine. And the reason he calls it that is that it has about 20 antennae sticking up all over it. And we drove around, and he fiddled with these receivers on his dashboard, and we listened to people's cell phone conversations. And as we drove around, the roads were completely empty, but it sounded like a cocktail party in the car. I mean, there were all of these voices, cell phone conversations, CB radios, walkie-talkies, and we could hear it all. And after an experience like that, you do tend to become slightly paranoid about your own communications.
Although I don't really care if somebody listens in and hears a conversation, typical conversation, "Where are you now?" "Oh, I'm on the way to the subway. I'll be home in 10 minutes. In Europe, there seems to be a much higher level of awareness of electronic surveillance than there is in this country. Why do you think that is?
Several reasons. One is that the press in Europe has been much more aggressive on these issues. Another is that there is actually a piece of legislation across the EU, which is the European Data Protection Act, which is a fairly aggressive piece of pro-privacy legislation. But the third reason is there's more surveillance over there. So, I mean, for instance, with video camera surveillance, with closed-circuit televisions, the figure now is that if you live in London and you go about your business and you go into work every day, your image is picked up on 300 cameras a day.
In the streets and then in the subways.
Yeah, all over. And that's been, it's sort of a fait accompli. I mean, there was no real debate over it, and now it's there. But as a result, people are, I think, keenly aware that that their society is changing.
People were upset when we learned that there were cameras being put up around New York City.
Yes, I think perhaps not as upset as they should have been or could have been.
Well, why do you think the great American newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post haven't done investigative reports that might keep the NSA publicly accountable and perhaps also give us an idea of just what the USA Patriot Act allows?
I think that it's unfashionable even among fairly aggressive journalists at this time to really go after the authorities that are doing this kind of work, because there's a sense that you're a naysayer and you're somehow not, you know, you're either against the you're either with the U.S. or against them. But it is a real oversight. I mean, in the case of the New York Times, one of the things I write about is an operation to eavesdrop on delegates at the UN on the east side of Manhattan. The New York Times did not run a single story on this as it was happening.
And John Ashcroft said that if you do write stories of that sort, you're giving comfort to the terrorists by asking about whether we can listen to them or not.
Yeah, and I think that's had a real chilling effect on journalists writing on this subject.
Still, the New York Times, the Washington Post, they didn't seem to be deterred in previous situations. The Washington Post gave us the whole Watergate thing.
This is true, but I think
with a lot of pressure applied from the White House.
Part of the issue here, though, is that in the case of, I mean, again, NSA standing for Never Say Anything, part of the issue here is that in order to corroborate a story, you need two sources, and that there's been, the Bush administration is more tight-lipped than any in history. I mean, it's much different than it was even for Woodward and Bernstein in terms of putting a story together. And I think that there's a general sense with these agencies and this kind of thing, electronic eavesdropping by government agencies, no one will talk about it. If you're lucky enough to find one person who will tell you about it, you're very unlikely to find somebody else who will corroborate a story.
Do we know who the current head of the NSA is?
Well, it's interesting you ask. They just appointed the new National Director of Intelligence, Negroponte, who is a diplomat, and people worried that he didn't have enough intelligence chops. So they hired him a deputy, who will be the deputy National Director of Intelligence, and that's Mike Hayden, who until just recently was the head of the NSA. I assume that a new head will be appointed for the agency. But it's interesting to see that this secret agency is clearly thought of as quite important by the administration if they're appointing Hayden in this very significant position.
You say that the practice of this world is that the more someone knows, the less they talk, and the more they talk, the less they know.
Yeah, that makes it difficult to write about, but in some ways more fun for me, because you meet a lot of kooky people who've been inside. People who've worked in these agencies are often quite paranoid. If they talk, they often have an axe to grind. And so that was part of the fun of it for me. I mean, it would have been difficult if I was writing these for a newspaper story, but for a book, you can sort of sort through these different rather colorful characters and figure out who you can trust.
And were you able to do this without relying on two corroborating sources?
Yeah, I mean, that was, if I had to corroborate every single thing I put in the book, it would have been a non-starter. But having said that, it again made it a challenge, because I could put the story out there and say, well, you tell me. Here's the person who told me. Here's my sort of view of how credible they are. Here's whatever circumstantial evidence there is. But at the end of the day, we're left sort of having to guess.
You managed to gain access to several important listening centers. How did you do that?
Well, the one that I went inside was a former listening center. So I traveled around, and we have these listening bases. The biggest is this one, Menwith Hill in England, which they wouldn't let me inside. But I went and I walked around, and it's in the middle of the English countryside. It's surrounded by cows and farms, and it's like a space base. I mean, there are 24 satellite dishes. 1,200 Americans work there, and they intercept communications around the clock. In that case, I couldn't get inside, but I did go to one in the Smoky Mountains of North Carolina that the NSA abandoned. And it's now home to just a handful of local astronomers. And so I could see the big satellite dishes and the underground tunnels. Really, it's about knowing where these stations are. If you can find that out and actually seek them out, they're astonishing to look at and experience.
You said that this is the third book that deals with the NSA, and the first two were by the same reporter. How has the NSA dealt with these books?
It's interesting. The first two books were by this guy, James Bamford, and when he wrote...
He was on our show to talk about
that. Oh, really? Yeah. When he wrote his first book, The Puzzle Palace, in 1982, the agency tried to shut him down. They really gave him problems at every step of the way. But the interesting thing is that over the years, they actually came to rely on that book. And now new recruits to the agency read his book, in part because you have 60,000 people who work for the National Security Agency. And for the sake of secrecy, it's very compartmentalized. So any new recruit isn't really going to have a snapshot of the whole agency itself. So it's interesting that this kind of gadfly, this outsider, his book ended up becoming kind of an insider's handbook.
But they didn't try to shut you down.
They didn't, but nor did they cooperate with me. I mean, I actually wondered at a certain point. They have a public relations staff of a dozen people or so, and it seems to me all they do is turn away reporters without asking any questions. So you wonder, what do they do all day?
But it's been said that the reason we know so much about the CIA and the FBI is that there are so many disaffected people working for them, and no matter how much those agencies try to keep secrets, somebody is going to talk to a reporter. Did that happen here as well?
Well, I certainly had a lot of people who did talk to me, yes. A whole series of people, some disaffected, some not, who thought, I mean, a lot of people feel that there's too much secrecy around this world, and that secrecy has actually been a handicap to the agency in terms of cooperating with other agencies and the outside world. So there were a lot of people who did end up talking to me and telling me their stories.
Do you have any sense of whether some valuable information has turned up because of all of this eavesdropping?
Well, there have been cases in which we've caught people on the basis of intercepts, various Al-Qaeda figures who've made the mistake of getting onto the telephone. And we also know, for instance, that if Bin Laden's, if the fact that we could listen in on Bin Laden's satellite phone hadn't been revealed, we would have kept listening. And I talked actually recently to Michael Scheuer, the author of Imperial Hubris, who was a longtime Bin Laden analyst at the CIA. And he said he thinks that September 11th wouldn't have happened if that story hadn't come out. We would have been able to keep listening on the phone, and we would have been able to prevent it.
But right now, most of the, if anyone wants to keep a secret, it's very easy to get around all of this. Actually, what they're probably learning is the stuff that really doesn't matter all that much.
And because they know we're listening, one thing you worry is that we only hear what they want us to hear. I mean, it's not only that they wouldn't say anything valuable on the line, it's that they might actually put out false alarms.
The real trick is to not use a cell phone, because the global positioning system in the cell phones actually allows the eavesdroppers to locate where we are.
Yeah, and the other, I mean, one of the solutions they're finding is email, which is extraordinary. I mean, Zacharias Moussaoui, the alleged 20th hijacker, used a completely anonymous email address, which was xdesertman1@hotmail.com. And he wandered into internet cafes and would anonymously use this email address. We know that many Al-Qaeda members and their affiliates now have scores and scores of these email addresses, and they'll use each one only once. It's very difficult to pinpoint those emails and find those people on the basis of that.
Have you become paranoid as a result of doing this book?
It's funny you should ask. I certainly started out initially getting quite paranoid, but then I pushed through that, and in a way, what I realized was that the agencies very well could listen to me if they wanted to, but I don't think that they would bother, A, because what I'm doing is not going to be especially interesting to them, but B, because they so have their hands full actually trying to zero in on the bad guys that it would be a colossal waste of time to listen to me.
Well, they used to say that the surest way to get an FBI file was to file a Freedom of Information Act request for the FBI.
Exactly. Well, it's funny. I was just reading recently in a book that the FBI's Freedom of Information Act office is a genealogy service for the old left, that people would come in and they had a file on everybody.
Now, do you think that because of this book, some reporters will be inspired to do more research, or is the lid so tight these days, the fear so strong, that we'll continue to have to rely on a couple of people to do all this work?
I hope that it will open things up a crack. I mean, my hope was to inspire some debate and make people realize that the secrecy is too effective. And I've actually already had people affiliated with various intelligence services get in touch and say this is a good thing and there should be less secrecy.
There were rumors that the NSA was involved in the arrest of Nelson Mandela in the 1960s. Have you heard about that?
I have not heard about that, actually. I don't know.
It's been denied, but then, of course, it would be
denied,
wouldn't it? You can find an excerpt from Patrick Radden Keefe's book, Chatter, on our reading room through quick links at WNYC.org. He will also be giving a reading and signing books tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Barnes & Noble store on 82nd Street and Broadway. And my great thanks to you for being with us today to talk about Chatter, Dispatches from the Secret World of Global Eavesdropping, published by Random House.
Thanks for having me.